How ready is Puerto Rico now, today on the world? I'm Marco Werman. 1 year after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico is still recovering, and some residents fear that the island and the nation are not ready to face the possibility of more powerful storms in the future.
Climate change is not coming. It's already here. And the administration needs to plan for that. That is not happening. Very frustrating.
Also, the world is watching to see how the powers that be in Washington will respond to sexual assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh.
It's a question that is at the heart of the Me Too movement around the world. So this is not just about the United States.
Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us on this Thursday. 1 year ago today, a tropical storm tore into Puerto Rico. Hurricane Maria turned out to be one of the worst disasters in the island's history.
This storm was the mother storm. It changed the whole island, and it changed every single person in it.
The people help each other. And for me, Maria, is the most beautiful lesson is we trust in us.
You're going to do the anniversary of Maria, it should be the un-anniversary.
But this monster unified us.
This monster unified us. Those voices are from our friends at The Takeaway. They've been on the ground in Puerto Rico all week. Host Tanzina Vega says a full year after the storm hit, the destruction caused by Hurricane Maria is still easy to see.
San Juan looks a little bit worn down and the rest of the island looks a little bit weathered. And I'm imagining that's just reaction to the storm, but it might also be because people are still waiting for insurance payments to be able to take care of their homes and rebuild. There's still a lot of rebuilding going on. There's a lot of concern about FEMA. There are some spray painted signs that say, you know, FEMA is not the solution. The solution is self-governance. And so we're seeing that as emerge as a theme.
I know you're no stranger to Puerto Rico. What were you not expecting to see or hear when you started talking to people there about what they're feeling as they hit this 1 year mark?
Well, there were a couple things. One was the challenge to the status quo, right? Often in Puerto Rico and among the Puerto Rican community, we talk, there's usually a question of either statehood. Do we do that or do we remain this sort of free associated state, right? A commonwealth. And this idea that, you know, maybe it's none of those things. Maybe it's a question of us taking care of each other and taking care of ourselves, you know, regardless of what the political structure is. There's a lot of people that are really focused on what they can do right here and now. The other thing that was interesting was the reconnecting of the diaspora, right? This idea that there are twice as many Puerto Ricans on the mainland as there are on the island of Puerto Rico. I'm talking about 5 million plus in the continental United States and a little over 3 million here on the island of Puerto Rico. These two communities are now beginning to realize that they really need each other. There's always been that connection, but I think this has really resurfaced and reconnected the diaspora, the broader diaspora of Puerto Ricans who on the mainland, for example, who can exercise political power, right? Who can exercise their right to vote in elections, unlike Puerto Ricans who live on the island. And so that was another thread that I wasn't expecting to necessarily come across.
Tanzina, I'd like us to hear from one of the many residents on the island that you've been speaking with. This is Omar Reyes. He's a law student at the Inter-American University of Puerto Rico. And it sounds like he had been toying with the idea of heading to the mainland after Maria, but then changed his mind.
I'm staying, definitely. Yeah, I'm staying. I'm not even playing with that idea anymore. Maybe at some point as a, you know, as a human being, I thought about my future. But I'm convinced that my future is in here, with my people, with my family, with my history. What we are actually doing here is trying to work out the creation of a new politics.
So, Tanzina, what does Omar mean when he says a new politics, and how popular is that idea?
It's actually very popular, particularly among young people and young grassroots activists that we were talking to. And it's similar. It sort of rings similar to me to what we're seeing in the United States mainland with movements like Black Lives Matter and the women's movement more largely. This idea that there's a little bit of a lack of a faith in traditional structures and traditional ways of governance. And so what these students are looking for is more of a communal sense of something that came out of the storm is that people felt like they were able to communicate that they wanted to to in ways that they hadn't before. They were forced to interact in ways that they hadn't before. And this idea that, you know, American independence and American individualism is something that really takes, you know, is a colonial holdover, I think, for many Puerto Ricans. And they were forced to reckon with the idea that, you know what, maybe we don't have to think that way anymore.
So what does all this mean for the conversation about independence or statehood right now? Because the last time I was down in Puerto Rico 2 years ago, I went to grocery stores. It seemed like the island was completely dependent on, like, Dominican Republic for frozen plantains. I mean, you can grow those plantains in Puerto Rico. Why aren't they there? And how can you become independent if all those dependencies exist?
What you just described is exactly the question that the people we talk to are trying to reckon with and rectify in many ways. You know, to be honest, more than 80% of the food on the island is imported. And that's something that a lot of people are hoping to change.
Tanzina, on this one-year anniversary, tell me about just the day-to-day making ends meet, finding the food you need and want. I mean, how hard is life right now in San Juan where you are?
Overall, things are moving along. There are streetlights that are out, so people are still directing traffic and trying to keep peace out there. But the infrastructure is coming back. It's not back 100%. And again, there are also a lot of shuttered storefronts, businesses that have shortened hours. We were hearing actually from a cab driver who's telling us that some of the biggest hotels in Puerto Rico, including the Caribe Hilton and the Ritz Carlton, have not reopened. So there's movement and there's tourism, but I think there's still a little ways to go.
Tanzina Vega, the host of The Takeaway, all this week in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Thanks for being with us for a few minutes today, Tanzina.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
The World's Carolyn Beeler has also been taking the pulse of Puerto Rico 1 year after Maria, how well it's recovering and what lessons it's learned for the next big storm. Among her stops, a small town in the countryside that was hit hard a year ago today.
The mountain region of Barranquitas in central Puerto Rico gets its name from the terrain. Barranca roughly translates to ravine or gully, and all the steep slopes around here meant that there were a lot of landslides after Hurricane Maria.
This area was full of mud and trees.
Barranquitas resident Israel Matos is driving me around, showing me all the raw patches of orange dirt that show where landslides were a year ago. We stop at one near a busy intersection.
The mud was so high, it was about 10 feet. It was above, you see that tree trunk? It was above that. All that road was closed.
Many roads were blocked for weeks, and that meant more problems.
The power company was telling the mayor, he said, we cannot get to Barranquitas because the roads are blocked. The big trucks cannot get through.
Matos and his neighbors didn't get power back until February, and only then because they hired a private crew to fix their part of the grid.
We had to do it ourselves. We cannot wait for the government.
Water was another big issue here. Matos lives on top of a hill in a big yellow house with purple trim that has a gorgeous view of the valleys below. You need electricity to pump water up this high, so when the power goes out, so does the water. Matos has long had a backup plan, a big cistern sunk into his front yard.
Okay, so we're up on a hill about 100 meters from your house.
We're standing on top of that cistern. It's capped with a concrete slab the size of a parking spot.
It's about 6,000 gallons. And that took me at least from September up to mid-November. And mid-November was so low that I decided to carry water from an aqueduct.
So you had 6,000 gallons of storage on your property,
yes,
and you still almost ran out of water after Maria.
That's correct.
And here's the thing. Israel Matos was probably one of the most prepared people for this storm. He used to be in charge of Puerto Rico's Office of the National Weather Service. It was his job to stand up at press conferences and tell people to get ready for storms like Maria. And still, his preparations weren't enough.
From my point of view as a meteorologist, I knew that a storm with that intensity will break havoc on the island, and I expected that. But what I didn't expect was that the response, it was so late, it was very frustrating.
As frustrated as Matos was, he was lucky. His house was damaged, but not badly. His neighbor's house, just on the hill, it was destroyed. Migdalia Rosado Sanchez shows me pictures of a single wooden wall standing amid rubble.
To me, it was like they placed a bomb inside. I lost everything that I had.
After Maria, Sanchez stayed with her daughter. They ate canned food and hauled river water for baths. The first FEMA water supply didn't get here for 2 weeks.
There wasn't any water or electricity. We had to buy a flashlight, candles, a little lamp, canned food. There wasn't any way to cook because there was no power.
Today, the valleys of Barranquitas are still dotted with blue tarp roofs. Otherwise, life has largely returned to normal. But in many ways, the town is no better prepared for a storm than it was a year ago. The power grid is still a fragile patchwork of fixes, like the one Matos and his neighbors arranged. There are more generators on the island now, but they're concentrated at hospitals and near other key infrastructure. Most of the water pumps in Barranquitas don't have generators, so when the power goes out, so does the water, for at least a third of the town's 30,000 residents. This problem is widespread across Puerto Rico. And what about the roads? The head of the local emergency management office, Aurelis Diaz-Rivera, says Barranquitas has gotten two new earth movers since Maria. That brings the total up to three. She says the equipment will help them clear roads faster after landslides, but it's still not enough. Her town isn't alone in this struggle. More than 40,000 landslides across Puerto Rico made it impossible to get out of some rural areas after Maria.
That is probably our biggest risk, is that transportation, that last mile.
FEMA's Mike Byrne is coordinating the federal government's disaster response in Puerto Rico, and he says access to rural towns may be the island's biggest vulnerability a year after Maria. One response has been distributing more emergency stockpiles closer to where people need them.
We had one warehouse last year. I now have five. I have probably 17 times the amount of water, four or five times the amount of food. And we've put them out in the communities, in the barrios.
In Barranquitas, there's now FEMA food and water stockpiled at the basketball stadium in the middle of town. Immediate changes like these are welcome to Israel Matos, but he hopes with most of the short-term recovery work now done, the conversation can turn to the long-term, preparing for the new reality of rising seas and stronger storms.
Climate change is not coming. It's already here. And the administration needs to focus on that and plan for that.
Matos is talking here about both Washington and San Juan.
That is not happening. It's very frustrating.
Across the island, many Puerto Ricans have lost faith in their government. They're installing solar panels for backup power and stockpiling food and water. A few weeks ago, Matos' neighbor, Migdalia Rosado Sanchez, was waiting for her new house to be finished so she could move in. She took me to see it. It's made of concrete this time, instead of wood. Better to stand up to hurricanes. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Barranquitas, Puerto Rico.
We'll return to the island tomorrow on the show and tell you about Alberto and Mireya, a married couple in Puerto Rico who were struck by misfortune twice. Alberto says he and his wife were in a fight against nature. Hurricane Maria was on the way and she was having a stroke. After the storm passed, he had to care for her without electricity and cobbled together a wind and solar-powered recovery room to keep his wife alive. It is an amazing story, and you'll hear it tomorrow here on the show. Coming up in a couple of minutes, President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, is facing allegations of sexual assault. It's probably the biggest political story in Washington right now, but it's also another Me Too moment globally. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Here's an update to a story you heard on the show a couple of days ago. The opposition leader Bobi Wine has now returned home to Uganda. He was just here in Boston getting medical attention for injuries he says he received in military detention. Earlier this week, I spoke with him before he left. When will you be returning to Uganda, and what precautions are you taking for your safety?
I'll be landing in Uganda this Thursday. And to be honest, the only precaution I take for my safety is speaking out. Because I know back in Uganda, many people, even those who don't speak out, have suffered the brunt of misgovernance. So I will continue standing for the truth, even when it means paying a price for it.
Speaking to the BBC at the International Airport in Nairobi, Kenya, before catching his flight back to Uganda, Bobby Wine said he was scared.
Yes, I'm afraid because the way the government is conducting itself is very worrying. But nevertheless, I'm going back home.
When Bobby Wine landed at Entebbe Airport, the police stopped him and said they would escort him home. A large crowd of supporters gathered at Bobby Wine's home today. This man said he hopes the government will calm down.
Just comply with Bobby Wine instead of trying to disorganize his rights, because he is a Ugandan and we are Ugandans. We have our rights.
Bobby Wine, who's also a popular musician, and his supporters are opposed to the longtime rule of President Yoweri Museveni, a man who's been in power now for nearly 33 years. Everything seemed to be on a fast track to confirmation. Then details about an alleged sexual assault dating back to the 1980s came out. Suddenly, President Donald Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, was part of a different story, another Me Too moment. Republican lawmakers are eager to put Kavanaugh's confirmation process back on track and move past these accusations. So is President Trump.
Look, if she shows up and makes a credible showing, that'll be very interesting, and we'll have to make a decision. But I can only say this. He is such an outstanding man. Very hard for me to imagine that anything happened.
There's a lot at stake here, and this is not just about politics. Frida Gitis is a contributor to CNN.com and The Washington Post. She's been following Me Too movements in other countries.
What I'm seeing is that the Me Too movement has gained traction over the months. You know, initially when it broke in the United States, when it really gathered force after the Weinstein case, the rest of the world was maybe watching from a distance. In some parts of the globe, there was skepticism that this would really catch on. But things have changed. Over the past maybe 9-10 months, the waves of activism, of determination by women to speak out and not let these cases of sexual abuse and sexual harassment go unnoticed, has really taken hold. And now what's happening in the United States in this particular case is really a part of a global movement.
Yeah, well, there's clear Me Too energy behind the people who want to hear Christine Blasey Ford speak, testify, and also an FBI investigation. As to the Kavanaugh hearing itself, what are you seeing around the world in terms of interest in that?
Well, normally this is something of an arcane process. The selection of a Supreme Court justice in the United States, normally you would not expect the rest of the world to pay very much attention.
Right.
But it's different now. From the perspective of women, especially in other parts of the world, this is not just about the selection of a judge in the United States. This is about a woman making a claim that she suffered at the hands of a powerful man, her claim being denied, and a power structure trying to decide how seriously it's going to take those allegations. It's a question that is at the heart of the Me Too movement around the world. So this is not just about the United States. The entire response of American society, of American politics, of the American government, of the American law enforcement to this unique single accusation has repercussions around the world. It tells the world how this is going to play out, because this movement really started in the United States. So this case is very, very important. No matter what the ultimate outcome is, the process itself is really important. Whether or not this case is treated with the seriousness that women think it deserves, and whether or not the men who are trying to downplay its importance get away with that, that will have repercussions around the globe.
Give us a few examples, if you would, of places where the Me Too movement has really gained momentum.
In places where the culture is more similar to the United States, maybe it's less surprising that it caught hold. For example, in the Netherlands, immediately thousands of women started speaking out, and there were thousands, literally thousands of cases that were talked about in the media. In France, it's been very interesting because immediately there was a backlash, and there was a open letter written by about 100 influential women saying that this Me Too movement was a Puritan reaction.
Right.
But after that, the push has continued and the government has imposed fines against men who harass women in the streets. And there have been accusations against other famous actors and directors. One of the most interesting things is what's happened in places that are far from the West. I happened to be in Sri Lanka, and I was talking to some women there, and I asked if they had heard about all this social commotion triggered by these accusations. And at the time, they said no, they had not heard about it, and they didn't really expect anything to change there. But they were wrong. Now there's a Facebook page that's called Sri Lanka Me Too, and women are speaking out there as well. In India, women in Bollywood have been making accusations that sound very much like what we have heard here about Hollywood. In China, one of the top Buddhist monks, he was accused of making inappropriate advances at Buddhist nuns. And he was basically removed from his post as a top monk. There are so many cases all over the world. You know, I think it's important also to remember that this is a pivotal moment and things have really intensified, but this is far from new. The question always was, will it make a change? Will each case be seen as an individual instance facing such tough odds of success, but not changing society? And now what we have seen is that something really is changing.
Well, if the Kavanaugh nomination goes forward, despite the accusation from Ms. Blasey Ford, will it be a blow to Me Too movements elsewhere around the world? I mean, what message will that send to powerful men, do you think?
Well, I think it depends on how it gets to that point. I think the process is very, very important. It's crucial that the process be seen as fair. You know, it's already not the best optics that it's all these men making the judgment. If Dr. Ford receives a fair hearing, if she gets the investigation, if this case is treated with seriousness and the outcome is believable and then Kavanaugh is confirmed, then this will not be a setback to the movement. If this is railroaded again, if we have something like the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill case, it will be a setback on the one hand, but I think it will enrage women even more. You know, I think the reason that this is happening now is because of what we saw during the presidential election in the United States when we heard the Access Hollywood tape of Donald Trump bragging about assaulting women and still he was elected. That energized women like nothing else. And I think if this Kavanaugh case is seen as another case of a man getting away with something, you know, initially it'll be a setback and maybe it'll energize men who want to cover up these transgressions. But I think it would also energize women even more.
Frida Gitas, a contributor to CNN.com and The Washington Post. Thanks very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. A controversial decision today by the agency that handles doping in world sports.
They're basically giving Russia a clean bill of health. They have been welcomed back into the anti-doping world. Their accreditation is being returned, and they say they can now be trusted to run their own anti-doping operation.
Big news in the sports world. That story just ahead here on The World. Marco Werman here with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. 3 years ago, the world of sports was rocked by scandal.
I was helping to facilitate one of the most elaborate doping ploys in sport history.
This goes all the way back to 1968. Every sport.
Was Putin aware of the existence of the Russian doping system?
Yes. We are top-level cheaters.
Those voices are from Brian Fogel's Oscar-winning documentary, Icarus. It tells the tale of Russia's massive, decades-long scheme to chemically enhance the performance of its athletes. Russia paid a price. It was suspended by the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, in 2015. But today, WADA's executive committee decided to lift that suspension. Lots of people in the sports world are stunned. America's own anti-doping agency says, today we failed the clean athletes of the world. To help us make sense of all of this, I asked the BBC sports reporter Alex Capstick what the WADA decision means.
They're basically giving Russia a clean bill of health. They have been welcomed back into the anti-doping world. Their accreditation is being returned, and they say they can now be trusted to run their own anti-doping operation. And to get this over the line, to do this, they compromised on two key criteria that were laid down in the roadmap, which is how WADA described it. The first was they had to acknowledge the findings in the McLaren report. That was an investigation which uncovered the extent of the deceit, of the scandal, the fact that it affected over 1,000 athletes in 30 different sports, that results at the London 2012 Games were compromised, and again at the Sochi Winter Olympics when dirty samples were swapped for clean ones. And they also had to open their laboratory in Moscow. This had been at the centre of the scandal, and hand over urine samples. Now, they haven't done that. They haven't done either of those things. What the Russians have agreed to is a watered-down version of the McLaren report. And instead of handing over the urine samples, they have agreed by the end of this year to hand over the raw analytical data associated or linked to those samples. So they haven't completed or complied fully with the roadmap laid down by WADA, but it's enough, WADA says, to make them compliant again with the rules and regulations.
How big of a crisis of credibility is this for WADA?
Well, it depends who you listen to, who you talk to. Travis Tygart, you mentioned, from the US Anti-Doping Authority agency, he has described today's decision as bewildering and inexplicable, a devastating blow to the world's clean athletes. He says that the IOC has WADA has bended to the will of the International Olympic Committee that has always wanted Russia's reinstatement. Lots of athletes around the world have said the same thing, athletes who are cheated out of medals in London 2012, Sochi 2014. They wanted a full apology from Russia, and that hasn't happened. Even the vice president of WADA, Linda Helleland, the Norwegian politician who was on the executive committee today, she opposed the recommendation for reinstatement. She said that today's decision has undermined the credibility of WADA. WADA knows that this is coming. It knows that this decision is not going to please everybody, but it says it simply had to do something, or they would never get access to these samples inside the Russian laboratory in Moscow.
So the World Anti-Doping Agency, they're based in Montreal, Canada. So why did their executive committee hold this meeting in the Seychelles? I mean, it's a luxury holiday destination in the Indian Ocean.
That's a very good question. This is an organization that's supposed to be strapped for cash as well. So they will tell you that the destination, the choice of the Seychelles was made many months, years ago. It's been in the diary. They hadn't chosen the Seychelles to keep people away from this particular meeting. It had always been there in the diary. So they're not saying there's anything untoward about that. But what people are querying is the time frame here, because it only became clear, and only because of a series of leaked emails, leaked letters that have been exchanged between WADA and the Minister of Sport in Russia. It all came to light very close to this meeting, just a few days before. So people are saying there wasn't enough time for a proper debate, that this was sprung on the executive committee or sprung on the rest of the world just before this crucial meeting. And they think there's something suspicious about that, that it was a deliberate act by WADA. And the fact that it was in the way in the station was, they're saying, just a lucky move for WADA, because it kept a lot of journalists away.
Mm. Alex Capstick with our partners at the BBC. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Let's turn to another suspicious story out of Russia. Meet Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Bashirov.
Our friends had been suggesting for a long time that we visit this wonderful town.
The two men say they were tourists just doing some sightseeing in Salisbury, England. They were speaking there in an interview with Margarita Simonyan, the editor-in-chief of the Kremlin-funded RT News. The British government says the men are suspects in the attempted murder of a former Russian spy and his daughter, Sergei and Yulia Skripal. The Brits also say the two suspects are spies with Russian military intelligence. Kirsty Wark is a host with BBC's Newsnight program. She spoke with Simonyan, the RT editor who did that interview with the Russian suspects, and things got tense.
Doesn't the manner of this interview concern you, and the fact that doesn't it just reinforce the idea that RT is a propaganda tool for the Russian state?
You did watch the interview, didn't you?
Oh, I watched the interview.
Did you see my face? Did you see the tone? You probably don't speak Russian.
I don't speak Russian, but I also looked at the transcript.
At that point, RT Simonyan hung up on Kirsty Wark. I asked Kirsty what she wanted to get out of that interview with Simonyan.
I wanted to interview her because she got the story, and whatever one makes of the story itself, she got it. And it was interesting to us to find out what her take was on it, you know, how interrogatory she was. And by doggedly keeping calling while I was in the radio studio waiting, we got through to Margarita and she agreed to the interview.
So what was Semenyon's take on her interview with these two men? Sum it up for us.
Semenyon's take was that the day before, Vladimir Putin had said in public that if these two men have got nothing to fear and they were being tourists, as was being suggested, then they should come forward. And hey presto, the next day they came forward. They contacted Margarita apparently by telephone. As she said in the interview, she's well known in Moscow. She's the editor-in-chief. And so therefore, they contacted her direct. And she did the interview with them. And so what I was doing really in that interview was getting, because she got the interview, talking to her about how she got the interview and talking to her about how she conducted the interview. I'll give you an example. In the end, they had told her that they'd been to Salisbury Cathedral. They loved the cathedral. The spire was 170 feet tall, et cetera, et cetera. And they took photographs. But were there any photographs of them at Salisbury Cathedral? No. Did she see any photographs? No. Did she ask them why they didn't bring the photographs with them? No. So I think she genuinely got the call from them, genuinely did the interview. But I wonder if she thinks they were genuinely tourists, truly. I'm not sure.
So there's this other moment in the interview that is not as dramatic as the one we just heard, but I actually found more telling. Let's hear that.
I saw with my own eyes that they do look completely like the people on the video that was released by the British police. So for that matter, I do believe they are those people. But as far as the story goes, I don't have any reasons to believe them. I don't know them. I haven't spent life with them. They're not my friends. But I have no more reasons to believe secret services who have been lying previously.
I only believe what I see with my own eyes, but I can't believe the lying British Secret Service. What did you make of that?
I've got no reason to disbelieve the Secret Service, because I imagine if there was Novichok in that room, it will be traceable in the reports, and it would be highly unlikely that in such a public high-profile case, the investigators would lie about Novichok in a hotel room.
Her answer there just kind of felt like a summation of the whole Russian MO, assert, consent, and then whataboutism, and no, I can't believe. It was kind of amazing.
Well, it's interesting, but the thing is, she is a journalist, and she is a senior figure in the station, and I do not doubt her journalistic credentials. But I think the idea that there is not some connection between Putin suddenly saying, well, I think these guys should come forward and do interviews and show themselves, and then suddenly showing themselves the next day, maybe they were reassured by Putin, I don't know.
So, Kirsi, you say that Semenyon is a journalist, but you also stated in that question that RT is propaganda and therefore not really journalism. What do you think she is?
It's funded directly by the Russian state, unlike, you know, the BBC, which is paid for with a license fee and has an arm's length relationship, a very long arm's length relationship with the government. And she seemed to suggest there was an equivalence, which there isn't.
So do you think Semenyon is a journalist or is she a propagandist?
Well, actually, I would not doubt it. I think she's a journalist, but I think that she's perhaps under strictures that I would not be under.
You know, there is an almost universal acceptance that what you say is true. RT is a source of pro-Kremlin propaganda. As journalists in the West who are free relatively to practice our trade and seek the truth, what do you think should be our posture regarding RT?
I think our posture should always be courteous, to hope they're rigorous, but because of this very close relationship with the Kremlin, to be skeptical, not cynical, but skeptical.
My colleague at the BBC, the presenter of Newsnight, Kirsty Wark, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much.
Earlier this summer, China put new tariffs on imported American meat. That didn't especially concern U.S. pork producers. They've dealt with this before. But there's a full-blown U.S.-China trade war going on now. North Carolina is the second largest pork producer in the U.S., but the state has also been hit hard by Hurricane Florence. Dave Warner is with the National Pork Producers Council in Washington. What can you tell us about how the pork industry, especially in North Carolina, how it was impacted by Hurricane Florence?
Well, certainly the farmers in North Carolina have been affected very greatly. I know that reports from the North Carolina Pork Council have been that, you know, some farmers are, I mean, some of them are having to use helicopters to get into their farms to take care of the pigs. Other farmers never left the barns. They stayed with their pigs throughout the storm. And there have been some losses. The last report I saw was that 5,500 pigs were killed. A lot of those were killed in barns from the winds wrecking the barns. But 5,500 out of almost 9 million pigs in the state isn't a lot. But for some farmer, it means maybe the loss of the entire herd.
So let's talk tariffs for a second, because this trade war with China has turned into a tit for tat between Beijing and Washington, and China retaliated very recently with a tariff on imported pork. So what can you tell us about the latest tariffs on U.S. pork?
Those are certainly affecting producers everywhere, you know, throughout the country. And it's not just pork, although we tend to be one of the agricultural products that get hit with tariffs because we do send a lot of pork overseas. China put a 25% tariff on U.S. pork in on April 2nd, and they added another 25% in June, early June, and that was on top of its existing 12% tariff. So we're at 62% this latest round. I'm not sure that they added to that, but that certainly has affected pork producers. There was an Iowa State University study looking at those tariffs, and actually it was only the first 25% tariff. From March through May, hog futures fell about $18 a pig, which on an annualized basis would be about $2 billion loss for the entire pork industry. So wow, it's certainly having an effect.
Well, one of our reporters, Jason Margolis, spoke with a soy farmer this summer. Soy also got hit with tariffs. A lot of concern there over these tariffs. What are you seeing in the pork industry? How are farmers reacting there?
Yeah, the soybean guys did take a big hit, too. And, of course, soybeans are very important to the pork industry. We feed our pigs corn and soybean meal. Mm-hmm. So, but I think prices on both of those commodities are pretty good domestically. Things can't get too much worse before, you know, you start to see people go out of business, and then that'll start to affect consumers.
Dave, I'm curious, have you ever visited pork processing plants in China?
I have not. I know that that the industry there is trying to modernize. It's still mostly backyard operations in China. But it's also starting to move toward more modernization, and that includes in their packing plants.
Does that move toward modernization concern you as somebody who represents pork producers in this country?
Right now, China needs to export pork. I suppose there could come a day where they don't, but I don't think that's going to be anytime soon. China consumes a lot of pork. Last year, we sent $1.1 billion of pork there. I think that represented about 1% of Chinese consumption.
Wow.
Of pork. So typically in our export markets, we're sending about maybe 5% of consumption. That growth there to China is the potential is huge, but we have to get past these trade disputes, and that has been our number one message to the administration, is these trade disputes need to end soon.
Dave Warner with the National Pork Producers Council speaking with us from Washington. Greatly appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a striking new ad campaign on the streets of New York City. New Yorkers, though, are not really the intended audience. It's for world leaders, specifically the ones in the city this week for the 73rd United Nations General Assembly.
This is a body that has the power, the resources, the influence to work to stop this war.
Elizabeth Myers is talking about the war in Yemen. The ad campaign is sponsored by her publication, Inside Arabia, which is based in Washington. It's putting some provocative images on New York City billboards, kiosks, and on those familiar bright red double-decker buses.
Looking out from the back of a bus is the eye of a Yemeni child, with the reflection of two flags in the iris, the Saudi flag and the Emirati flag.
She's talking there about Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, two U.S. allies involved in the Yemen war. On the side of the bus, along with a picture of the child, is this message.
The war in Yemen, the world's worst man-made crisis. And then at the bottom of the image, with a background in bright red, is the UN must stop the war.
The man at the UN trying to do that is the special envoy to Yemen, Martin Griffiths. So far, he's been unable to get the sides together to even talk. Elizabeth Meyer says New York buses will show six different ads while the General Assembly is in session.
And each particular graphic has a different caption. So one will show that there are 11 million children on the brink of starvation right now. Another will show that there were 68 civilians killed in one airstrike. In another airstrike, there was a school bus targeted with 40 children on it. So the image is stark and beautiful and tragic all at the same time, and the words are devastating.
Meyer says time is of the essence because this war, now in its fifth year, is making daily life dangerous for Yemeni civilians. She wants Americans to pay attention.
I think people are noticing and they're reacting, and I just hope that the reaction is not just like, oh, you know, here's another crisis that's not in our part of the world, you know, not much I can do about it, but actually there is.
Like lobbying members of Congress or learning which U.S. companies produce weapons used in the Yemen war. Meyer says that world leaders, including American politicians, have been able to dodge uncomfortable questions about their country's involvement in the war. The intention of the ad campaign is to put the issue basically in their faces.
So it's buses, billboard trucks. We have kiosks on the street that you walk by and you see the graphic. And we also have the huge billboard down on 7th Avenue and 34th Street, one of the busiest intersections in New York City.
The UN General Assembly is in session through the beginning of October. Ample opportunity for world leaders and New Yorkers to get some education about the war in Yemen as they're gridlocked behind a big red bus. Snow Patrol, the rock band from Northern Ireland, has been together for more than 20 years. That's a generation, and a lot can happen in that time, especially with rock band personalities. Wildness, released earlier this year, is their seventh studio album. In it, the band's lyricist and frontman, Gary Lightbody, is open about his struggles with depression, anxiety, and sobriety.
Boy, did I not want to go and see a therapist. But when I did, things started to change. It really did. And talking about one's feelings, one's darkness, one's darker places, it's hard, but it's really vital.
The first snow, first winter of my life, I was told it was the height of me.
You know, there's some dark subject matters for sure, but it's an album full of joy, full of hope, full of light, you know. It's an album of finding your way out of those dark places.
This is your grace, and I don't know why.
First song I wrote, start to finish, 2014, was Don't Give In.
This is your grace, and I don't know why, and I don't know why.
You know, it's kind of on the nose as far as what I was going through, but it was also a kind of beacon, a torch in the darkness for me, because it showed not only the message of the song, but it also showed me that I could write a song start to finish, and that I still had that in me. Nirvana is the reason why I'm in a band. Hearing Nevermind for the first time when I was 16, it changed everything. I grew up in Northern Ireland in the 80s, which was a very dangerous kind of time in the Troubles.
Police reported 56 hijackings, 17 bombings, 23 shooting incidents, and nearly 200 attacks on the security forces.
My mum and dad never put their stuff on me, so I grew up kind of confused as to why people hated each other. So all I wanted was people to love each other from when I was a kid. But I think the current situation, I think I just want the same thing as I was when I was a kid. And people stop screaming at each other and we start to talk more. Because at the moment, people are just screaming over the top of each other. No one's listening to each other. And that is, that's nowhere. We don't get anywhere from there.
Can you heal me, baby? I've been dancing in this fire for way too long.
I'm not a religious person, so the only thing I can believe in is humanity, and I want to keep, you know, I want to keep believing in them. And there's so many extraordinary people in the world. There's so many people that are trying to make a difference and that are trying to be positive about things, even in among all the screaming and shouting. So I believe that there is still hope.
Where there's humanity, there is hope, and vice versa. That's Gary Lightbody of Snow Patrol. The band's new album is called Wildness. And that'll do it for today's show. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.